Welcome to Micro College. This is Jacob Hunt, the director of Thoreau College, Micro College located in rural western Wisconsin. Speaking to you today in beautiful October day, 2025. If you're listening right now, we are accepting applications for our spring 2026 Metamorphosis Gap Semester, as well as the fall 2026 Metamorphosis Gap Semester. We're going to be having a great conversation today about formative education and about microcolleges and holistic education, many things that connect with the work that we do here. So if any of this is interesting, check us out on the internet, thoreaucollege.org, and consider sending an application or getting in touch. Today, my guest is Chris Higgins, who is a professor of education at Boston College. He is professor and chair of the Department of Formative Education at the Lynch School of Education and Human Development at Boston College, where he co-directs the BA program in Transformative Educational Studies and the PhD program in Formative Education. A philosopher of education, he has written on the existential dimensions of teaching and learning. The idea of education as a public good, humanism and liberal learning, imagination and aesthetic education, practice and vocational formation, and the experimental tradition in higher ed. He is the author of two books, The Good Life of Teaching and Ethics of Professional Practice, published in 2011, and more recently, Undeclared, A Philosophy of Formative Higher Education, published last year, 2024. Thank you so much for joining us on Micro College, Chris.
Thank you for having me, Jacob. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk with you today. Your book, Undeclared, is really highly recommended for people interested in everything that we talk about here at on the Micro College podcast. It's really wonderful to have someone thoughtfully articulate so many a great variety of perspectives and really theorize some of the stuff that feels like is closely connected to what we're working on. But here on the podcast, we always begin with people's biographies. So I'd like to ask you, where were you when you were 18, 19, 20 years old? And what were the influences in your life? And how has that shaped who you are today?
Yeah, I love that question. Great place to start. I grew up in Newark, Delaware, little university town, not too far from Philly. And my dad was a school teacher. My sister got interested in alternative education as a college student and had me moved from public school to a little school called the Newark Center for Creative Learning. So I'm trying to give you some background to how where I was at 18. You have to know that I had already had a taste of a school in which people were not age grouped. Students sometimes designed their own classes. We called our teachers by their first name. It was a sort of inquiry approach to learning. So a group of people inspired by Dewey and Montessori and others had started an alternative school and put creativity at the center. And I was lucky enough to experience that. So by the time I was 18, I had then been through public high school, and I just had this sense that there had to be something more than the kind of, let's call it studenting, the kind of, trying to organize your intellectual life around somebody else's syllabus, somebody else's assessments, a kind of individualistic competition, knowledge as a possession, who has more of it. The whole thing just didn't seem like it could be what the life of learning was about. And with that in mind, and sort of with my imagination somewhat romantically fired by books like James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, I had a sense there must be another kind of place, and I had good grades. So I applied to a bunch of places. It's interesting, given that I ended up writing a book about scale in higher education, celebrating a college that was tiny, Black Mountain, and I'm talking to the Micro College podcast. It's interesting that I almost went to Swarthmore, and instead I went to Yale. And so at 18, I was leaving Newark, Delaware. I was, to be honest, kind of excited to get out of my parents' house. And we could talk about later, we could talk about whether education is de-rooting and what it would mean to have an education rooted in place. But I don't want to deny the fact that I needed to get out of there. There was something good about going, what was it, 5 hours away to New Haven, Connecticut, and trying to do my own thing on my own terms. There's something to be said for our ritual of independence around this time of life as well. So that's where I was at 18, was heading off with a copy of James Joyce in my hand, heading off to New Haven, expecting to find a truly formative liberal education experience.
Cool. And did you find it?
I set you up for that one, didn't I? I mean, I guess I want to add one wrinkle to my first answer too, which is, I mean, not to dive right into the deep end, but it is interesting when you ask somebody like, where were they at when they were 18? And you're asking about sort of what was their outlook, what was their sensibility, what were they hoping and fearing and thinking and doing? And I think we should acknowledge that it's not entirely clear we have access to that or easy access to that, right? I mean, it's not just a matter of saying that memory is dim, but we're not primarily interested in this case in memories from the perspective of our adult self, of a former self, but we're actually, do we still have some contact with that perspective of the younger self, right? So like a full-blooded version of that would be the kind of thing where you open an old dresser drawer that you'd forgotten was even there, and you find some notebook you had written in at the ages of 17 and 18, and there's an entry saying, I don't know when you'll find this, but I hope you haven't given up on the following ideals, or I hope you haven't become cynical like all the other people I see around me. And you might have a jolt of feeling like, wait, I think I have. I think this person, you might have a sense of like, I don't even quite recognize the person who wrote this. So it is interesting to ask for this kind of time travel question of can we re-inhabit that perspective? And of course, part of maturation, for better or worse, is we layer life experience layers so that I have a different sense of what it means to be 18 than I did when I was 18. Right? I mean, I don't know. There's any, I'm 58 now. There's hardly any advantages to being 58, but at least one of them is I have some multiple perspectives on what it means to be 18 or 28 or 38 or 48. So I just went meta. I don't know if that's if that's interesting or helpful, but the answer to your question, yes and no. I mean, not really. I found that too many of the classes were really not geared toward young human beings seeking answers to life's questions. And I don't mean just a bull session where there's no rigor and no text, but I mean, there were professors teaching their specialties and not always really tuned into what it would mean to find, to build that bridge, as Dewey puts it, between the lived world of the student and the subject matter, right? You don't just say, hey, let's talk about your current world and just forget about the text or forget about history or forget about discipline. But you also don't say, just jump into this without trying to build any kind of bridge so it could be connected to, what you're actually wrestling with. And that happened too seldom for my taste. But on the other hand, the informal educational aspects of undergraduate were amazing. Talks around a dining hall table or late night sessions where we should have been studying, but we weren't, those were probably the most formative aspects of just really good conversations about ideas. I do think though that colleges, I'll say one last thing about this, which is that I think we need to try to work to build a kind of third space between spaces that are intellectual, but also academic, and spaces that are not academic, but tend to be kind of anti-intellectual. What's that third space where it's not on academic terms? There's not a clear teacher in the mix, at least not somebody who's assessing you and driving the whole process. So it's not an academic space, but it is an intellectual space. There's a kind of rigorous, joyful pursuit of the complexity of the world, trying to understand ourselves and the world. And those spaces are hard to get. You can sometimes feel like your only choice is talking to a professor very scholastically or playing beer pong in the dorm or something like that. What's the middle ground, you know?
I really you what you just said there is you stated very specifically also in the book, and I really appreciated that insight because it does, I think, resonate with one of the things that we are offering our students here at the micro college, like Thoreau College, which is yeah, it's important that it has an academic component, right? We are reading some books and we're talking about ideas, but it's also not, not a university campus in which people are really worried about grades. They're worried about their outcomes. They're more that conversational space is something that really I think can flourish. And also different contexts around a meal, around lunch, around a campfire, or when you're working in the garden. These are contexts when some of the best conversations happen, and can only happen when you have the right scale and the right mixture of activities, where you have interactions between people of different stages of life. And so I think that what you've articulated is really beautiful, and I think increasingly difficult to find, because what I see is that people do need to actually be invited much more directly into that space of conversation. People have things in their ears, right, which is a real barrier, or they're just in this in the technological realm. Like the in-person informal conversation is something that doesn't necessarily come automatically anymore, to young people and to anyone.
And if the student culture or the culture of the institution is such that you're just considered some kind of massive nerd to ever bring up a book or something from class outside of class, that's going to be difficult. But I mean, it's so cool when you make those things spill over. Like you're in philosophy class, you're reading Aristotle's Theory of Virtue, and it's a little bit like, what? What is this all about? But you bring it up at dinner, and your friend, my friend Tally, one time at dinner, I remember him saying, people don't know what they're talking about when they talk about courage. People imagine that they already know whether they're courageous or not. And he challenges, he gave us a thought experiment. He said, what if you were in the military and somebody rolled a grenade into the center of a circle of your closest comrades, and you had a helmet in your hand, and the only way to save the group would be if you dove on the grenade, helmet down. It would kill you, but you would save everybody. Would you do it? And somebody started answering. He said, quiet, you have no idea whether you do it until you're in the moment. Like that kind of conversation where somebody was actually theorizing college, sorry, not college, in college, theorizing courage live for real over dinner, but then connecting back to something that just spurred it because, Aristotle defines courage as putting fear in its place, not giving it too much or too little weight in your deliberations. It's kind of abstract, right? And then suddenly a real person is telling you have no idea what your virtues are until life will reveal them for you. I mean, that's to me, that's the intellectual life, is it spills from class to conversation. It's serious, but not it's playful at the same time. It's serious play.
Yeah, that's another phrase you use in the book that I really resonated with. I think, right now our students, I'm at home while they're off on a canoe trip up in the Boundary Waters, up the North Woods of Minnesota. But often I feel, things like that, what we are doing is play, right? And this is for Schiller's Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man, right, talks about, human beings being at their highest in the form of serious play. And I think that's one of the things we're able to provide our students in a context like Thoreau College. And I think you talk about that beautifully in the context of Black Mountain as well. There's a playfulness to the way that the arts are practiced, we're practiced in a place like that, that is, it's hard to find in everyday life, unless you have to kind of create a context of it for adults, even young adults, to have that experience. And it is really a high form of being a human.
And do you think maybe a good teacher, one of the things they do is they are helping the group sort of find that middle ground of serious play and steer away from the kind of play that is just frivolity, just goofing around, and trying to steer away from the kind of seriousness that is unplayful, that is just gravitas or something like airlessness. And so and that can be hard because you could find one discussion. Everybody's so serious that it's as if their life depends on the position they're holding. And it could be helpful to introduce a little spirit of, well, why don't you try taking the other position or something like that? But another discussion, you could have a group that the whole thing is just clearly just an exercise and nobody feels the force of any of the questions. Then you have to find some way to increase the stakes, like when Socrates says to Meno in Plato's dialogue, the Meno, Meno starts sort of doing a debate kind of thing. And finally, Socrates says, what do you yourself believe, Mino? Like, put some skin in the game.
Yeah, beautiful. So, I think we're dancing around here your central concept, and which I would like to ask you to define, which is formative education. I think yeah, it's already a concept that I've started to inform the way that I explain what we're doing here, and yeah, the whole book, it gives different aspects of it to it. And now, yeah, you're running a PhD program in formative education. Is that something that existed before you got there, or is this a,
Nope.
yeah.
No, and I'm not sure it exists in too many other places around the world, really. I mean, it's kind of what we're doing is pretty unusual in that we are radically interdisciplinary. I'm a philosopher. My colleagues are historians, anthropologists, humanistic psychologists, and people coming out of design thinking, learning sciences. And our students apprentice themselves to all five disciplinary traditions. So I think we're pretty novel, and because the PhD has always been like synonymous with hyper specialization, and we're saying that the questions that interest us are formative questions, including some of the grand social challenges of the day, questions about climate change or the erosion and unraveling of democracy, or about our relationship to technology. These are questions that have a formative dimension, right? They're not just technical questions that have to do with the shaping of vision and values, and they're not the kind of questions that fit in a single disciplinary box. So our kind of gambit is that if we want to actually think about formative experience in a serious way, we need to be interdisciplinary and not just multidisciplinary. Some departments have professors off in this corner or that corner doing a different thing, but we're really working together, talking to each other across these disciplinary boundaries. So you're asking a question that my students sometimes ask me, which is, we're in a department of formative ed, but what is that exactly? Because they get asked that, people say, what are you studying? Which is the challenge of, instead of just saying history, everyone recognizes it, or philosophy, but actually doing something synthetic like this requires getting used to some new terms. Now, as a chair of an academic department, I'm comfortable with and actually like the fact that the phrase, the concept invites questions. I don't actually want to like come up with the four F's of formative ed and brand it and push it out as, have a TED talk and say, we've defined formative ed for all time. I like the fact that a broad definition, and I'll give you one in a second, invites more questions. So what we could define formative ed, I define it a little bit more specifically in the book, but let me just talk about a really broad working definition for like the work we do here at Boston College. Educating whole persons for lives of meaning and purpose. And I think if you tell somebody that, what they're going to say is, well, what do you mean by a whole person? What are there different parts to a human being? And what would it mean to nurture them all, or to bring them into some kind of integrity? And what kind of meanings and whose purposes? I welcome those questions. I mean, to me, I'm like, let's go. That's right. I mean, I believe education is a quest for understanding, not a recitation of things already discovered. That's a kind of loose construct at the center of our work. Now, in my book, I do advance some further claims. I lean into the idea that formative education is something driven first and foremost by the student. So that would probably lead us to have to distinguish between maybe early phases of formative ed, where it seems pretty clear that, I mean, I think even a toddler is a co-director of their learning, but maybe they're not fully the architect. But as we get into the college years, I stand by the idea that formative ed isn't something that can just happen to you. This is a process where your agency is involved, or it's not happening. And that means, of course, that one of our jobs in higher ed is to awaken that agency if it's slumbering, which it often is, given our K-12 system, which you can't blame anybody who has been trained in a system of hoop jumping for their entire life, being miseducated to think that their life is a resume and is a race for credentials and a vicious individual competition to win a kind of, March Madness to get into the college that has the highest rating and rejects the most people. I mean, after a process like that, it's a wonder that people are on their feet at all, but they may need some help sort of deprogramming from that and finding their own agency. And that's not just today. I mean, there's a story I tell in the book of an advising session at Black Mountain. The student recalls how his advisor was the kind of founding figure of Black Mountain, John Andrew Rice. And he was sitting in a rocking chair on the porch of Lee Hall, and it was, the beginning of college, and it was the first advisement session. And Rice was relaxed and happy to meet him. And they just started spending time together, looking at the mountains. And then he said, "What are you interested in?" And the student was floored and said, "I've never been asked that before." Right. So it's not, this was, 1933. So it's not like this is a brand new problem. Agency has to be awakened in the learner. Your interests can and should must drive this process if it's going to have real substance and vitality.
Yeah, very well put. Yeah. I think one topic that you mentioned there that you tackle early on in the book is this concept of whole person education. And that's, I gotta say, when I first re started reading the book early on, like you started approaching, you problematized this concept of whole person education. And it's a phrase that we have used here, higher education for the whole human being, things like this. And it's like, oh no, I'm not gonna like this. He's gonna he's gonna give us trouble with this core concept. But I really, and I mean, it's wonderful to take apart that and really ask what is meant by that and what is a whole person, right? And I think above all, you do right early on what I think that any good educator must do is to really examine what is a human being, right? What is a person, right? Personhood. And so one of the things I take from your definition of formative education is we are assisting, we are participating in creating context for these students to develop, a robust, active sense of personhood, which is a really high calling. And I think you give some great examples of how that can go well and some hindrances to that. But yeah, can you talk a bit about what you came to understand about holistic, whole person education and what in the end that should be included in that, or what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, like you, I'm sure I always felt called by that idea. I felt troubled by the narrowness. I mean, if what do we say is the sort of operating definition of the educated person in our school system? I don't mean like on websites, but if we actually look at practices, what's the kind of real idea driving it? And I think it's something like an educated person is a high-speed, pressure-proof symbol manipulator. Which of course is not a human being, right? And that doesn't even describe.
GPT,
Yeah, exactly, right? We got that covered now, so maybe that'll free us up to shoot our aim a little higher. But I mean, that's can't we say that that's not at all even an adequate description of intellectual development? So it takes one part of us misunderstands that and treats it so narrowly that it doesn't even get that right. But of course, it leaves out of the equation our civic selves, our moral selves, our spiritual selves, our aesthetic selves, our vocational yearnings, and we could go on, right? So I felt called by the concept. I've as a philosopher of ed, I've spent my entire career sort of drawing attention to educational aims that have been displaced in our extreme myopia in education. So it's always spoken to me, but I started to feel like it's become one of those cliches that just, I hear you that at first you were a little bit like, hey, he's giving me trouble here. But I guess I thought we all need this trouble a little bit because our words can lose their grip on reality and become a phrase, a slogan, a way of signaling our mission to each other. Here, at BC, which is Jesuit, one of the terms everybody loves is discernment, and it's a great term, and we use it too much. I had a colleague at one meeting half jokingly say, "Before we get started, everyone come over here and discern what sandwich you want for lunch." Right? I mean, that's mission signaling. That's saying actually nothing about what it means to sit with an idea or a decision, what it means to contemplate or reflect, or it all it says is we're all part of BC. We're part of this Jesuit tradition. And that can be important, but so I think probably BC should have a 1-year moratorium where we're not allowed to say discernment and people have to find a way to translate the idea into living language. And probably likewise, a lot of places like Thoreau, you should probably give yourself a moratorium and say, you may not use the phrase whole person for 1 year and just see what happens, you know?
Yeah.
See what emerges. But so once I started looking into the concept, I mean, I grew up on the idea of these phrases are just like in the air, right? Well-roundedness. I had it, as I was talking about, when I headed off to Yale, I had this feeling of like, I want a liberal education. And I didn't really know what that meant. I just had a vague sense that it was somehow non-vocational, which I later discovered and thought through and realized was almost entirely wrong, that those two should be opposed. And I thought it's going to be a well, it's going to lead me to be a well-rounded person. But then, you know, you arrive on a campus and it turns out that's been operationalized as distribution requirements to make sure you visit every part of campus at least once. And it's not at all clear how that means that you're well-rounded. I mean, possibly you're intellectually well-rounded, but then what about the rest of you? And you're probably not even intellectually well-rounded if you took a class or two in some area just because you were forced to, and maybe your school never offered you the chance to integrate what you learned into your overall outlook. So in that essay, you're talking about soul action. I try to give us all trouble and make sure that we don't assume that it's a sweet, wonderful concept we already have our hands on, but to try to make it seem, I think, what it is, which is a little bit more mysterious and austere than we sometimes take it. Because it seems like, first off, there's at least two major components to the idea of holistic education, I argue. The first is educating all the worthy aspects of ourselves to some degree of, maturity or fullness. That's kind of wholeness as completeness. Did you leave something out? So that part of the phrase educate the whole person is sort of saying, don't starve any important aspect of your humanity. And that's crucial. But I think that's only part of the equation, because what if you educate a bunch of different aspects of yourself to some fullness, but then you leave each in a little compartment, and you're your civic self when you're at the town meeting, and you're your moral self when somebody poses you a moral dilemma, and your aesthetic self when you're at the museum, and your intellectual self when you're in school. But actually, where's you? You're a series of role players. So it seems like the second task of whole person education has to be personal integration, integrating these diverse aspects of yourself into some kind of unity of character or outlook. So that's the kind of basic analysis that I offer in Soul Action, and then I try to richly embody the challenges of that. I don't know what you thought about that part, but I, with my little fake characters, Silas and the Monas, but I was trying to get at the fact that we meet people who they're unified, but because they've just sort of like simplified themselves, and they just kind of ignore some parts of ourselves. And then we meet other people who have a kind of breadth, but then maybe they are compartmentalizers and everything's in a little separate silo. So those are the kinds of problems I tried to puzzle through in that first long essay, Soul Action.
Yeah, I can't help mentioning you also made great use of pretty much the only like one of the very few good poems that Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau, wrote. I mean, when I turned the page and saw that, I was like, that is the only poem from Thoreau that I can remember, actually. He's very like obviously a poetic writer, like Walden is filled with beautiful passages, but in terms of verse, this poem, "I am a parcel of vain strivings tied by chance bond together, dangling this way and that, their links were made so loose and wide, methinks, for milder weather." And just, I think that I've read that before with high school students and with college students, because I think that's an experience of being a modern person and certainly a young person. Given contemporary education, you've got a bit of algebra, you've got a little, little home ec, you've got a little, your social life, and it doesn't, how does it hang together, right? And one of the reasons that I like Thoreau, and I think he brings to, as an inspiration for the work that we're doing, is he is very early, I think, in experiencing some of these modern conditions, and he's expressed it in this way. So I got that raises the question, like, how do we actually do that? How, as educators, how do schools or universities or colleges actually help that integrative function? If we've got all the distributions out there, take a little bit of this and a little of that, right? What are the conditions as you see it for helping that integration to happen?
Yeah, so one we've already talked about, which is a culture of conversation. I think that conversation is the medium of sort of knitting things together, making connections, right? Conversation has a way of, it's very different than a seminar, right? Because you kind of jump around, but that jumping around, it has its own logic, right? That's you sort of, as I said, knitting together the disparate aspects of your experience. You don't have to keep each potted in a separate, planted in a separate pot, you know? But wait, that reminds me of something I heard in class. Oh, you're talking about the authoritarian personality and Hannah Arendt. You know what? That reminds me of my uncle or something like that. Like those kinds of connections, they take a special kind of space that's tolerant of zigzagging, you know, and a lack of precision. You're not going to sound totally precise trying to figure out what terrorizes you about political discussions at your Thanksgiving table. It may, you know, you may be searching for words and whatnot. So I think conversation is the medium there, and I think that a culture of conversation on a campus is crucial. And maybe the reason why I stress the word culture is I think sometimes we slip into a kind of program orientation, like, okay, we need more conversations. We're going to start a new program called Conversation Wednesday Conversations or whatever. And maybe it'll be a great program. But like if it isn't there in the ethos, you know, in the water, so to speak, then probably adding in a program, you know, so you want your students to be more reflective. So you say, okay, we're going to add reflection sessions to every course. Okay, maybe that will help, but maybe not if every student is in a stance of studenting and they're mainly aiming for the grade and the credential. And if even the professors are doing their own, you know, passing the class by adding the reflection session to please the provost. And then everybody is just going through the motions. And so I think the first thing is just to look at the culture of your place and you know, try to build a community that truly cares about personhood, like you said, and that truly savors conversation, and the other thing we already mentioned, serious play. So that's one. Another is I think that you know, you can what's the best order to do this? So I think looking at the curriculum and trying to create genuine moments of integration in the curriculum. Now, I'm not sure that that means that every class has to be interdisciplinary. I think that there is something to be said for the kind of intentional vertigo that classic liberal education inspires, where you're reading a work of literature and then you walk across the quad and you go to your econ class and everything is redescribed as supply and demand and exchange, and trying to move back and forth between the world of Jane Austen and the world of Adam Smith is interesting, right? And then actually finding out that maybe there's overlaps and maybe Mansfield Park is a novel about slavery and sugar coming into the UK and these things come together. Like, so having some differentiation, I don't think we want the curriculum to be a big mush, right? But where in the experience of the student are those integrative acts? Instead of having gen ed requirements as a kind of you know, distribution, what people used to call, I like the term scattering requirements, because it's just so honest. Like, all right, you got this major, you might become too narrow, so let's scatter you a bit too, right? Instead, what if we thought of, you know, integration requirements instead of gen ed, you know, serious inquiries that cut across the disciplines are question driven. And so we could play with the curriculum, we could look at the culture. Last but not least, there could be specific assignments that help with that. So in our major transformative educational studies, the first class everyone takes is a class called the Educational Conversation. And one of the main pieces of writing students do in that class is a kind of educational autobiography in which they're revisiting and revising their own narrative of how they became who they are. They're rethinking their key formative influences in light of where they are now in college, suddenly being asked to be the lead architect of their learning, perhaps for the first time, in light of some of the readings. How might you rethink the key moments, the key influences, the kind of medium in which you became you? So I think even specific assignments could help with that integrity work, but we could look more broadly at the culture of a place and at its curriculum as well.
That that educational autobiography, I think, is really an important thing. It's one of the reasons I asked this question of all the guests on the podcast. But also as students, we in our programs we're presenting students with this wide range of experiences. There's intellectual experiences, there's community experiences, there's physical experiences, and one or the other, or a bunch of those are going to be challenging and to each student, and they might not be successful the first time out, or they might have a frustration. I think it's important, in those moments to, and also moments of success and real kind of flourishing, to say, how would you tell that story to someone back home? And you're kind of that for me is a formative activity. Like, what was that experience? What have I learned about myself? What'll I do different next time? And what's the story? What's the big picture that is revealed by these experiences, frustrating or exhilarating, whatever they may be.
Absolutely. I mean, there are definitely moments in college where, students realize that the conversation they're having is sort of a redescription of the values of the place they came from or their parents or and it's one thing to just like sort of nod and say, oh yes, we should be critical of that. But on the other hand, inside you're thinking, wait, are my parents destroying the planet? Does your environmental studies class telling you that your parents are destroying the planet? Or where you're in a critical education class and you're thinking, were my high school teachers indoctrinating on behalf of the military industrial complex or something? So these are moments of genuine wondering, but then how do you actually stay true to the person who grew up in your small town while also how do I talk about how do you keep those roots even as you branch? And I like that idea of like, how would you explain this to someone back home? Dewey says at one point, he says, try the experiment of communicating something of some complexity to someone who's different than you, and you'll find that your own understanding of it shifts in the process.
Yeah, that's a great exercise. Yeah. Explain it to a 5-year-old, explain it to your grandmother. Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah. That's awesome.
What
Well,
do you think about, can I say, I have one more moment on this topic? I think there is a thing that happens in college where you come back for that first Thanksgiving or Christmas holiday, the winter holiday. You and I both have kids in college right now, the same college, in fact. Go Bard. There could be a thing where you come back for that first holiday or that second holiday, and suddenly there's a disconnect with your family, right? Which is cool that you've changed. But and your family in some ways has launched you and said, go get this, go try this. And then you come back and there's this gulf possibly. I don't know if we talk about that enough of how do you grow without that kind of experience of alienation. I think there's too many humanities professors who are glib about the idea that they're trying to get people to turn on the values they grew up with. And not necessarily saying they'll be there for the long haul to help the student then reintegrate, not just have a critique of an old worldview, but sort of what's the new worldview that takes its place? And is it a livable one? Is it more than gestures of refusal and critique? What's the positive ethos that guides it? And how do you stay connected to your hometown, your roots, your home values? Sorry to prolong this point, but it fascinates me.
Totally, yeah. What that makes me think of is, an image that I've thought about with some of our programs is kind of the Joseph Campbell idea of the hero's journey, right? You know, the student, as you said, they leave home, they leave their place, and they're inevitably going to be changed by that experience. There'll be challenges, there'll be victories, so, and they'll come back with something ideally of real, a deeper sense of self, real knowledge, real transformation. But then there is the return. There is a reintegration that, and that, going home to Thanksgiving or going home for the summer between years is often a hard moment, right? It is, you are different and the people at home are the same, or they seem to be the same. And that's, so that would be another integrative function. How do you reintegrate into your community, into your family?
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to, that we've been focusing really on the, the first essay, the first kind of third of the book here. I think another really, the second part, which is fascinating, and it's something I've already shared with some of my colleagues, is the second part of the book, which centers on one of the great experiments in higher education in American history, which is Black Mountain College. Can you just introduce our audience? I don't think on the podcast we haven't really talked about Black Mountain before. There's no current staff or people there to talk about because it is a historic event and historic college that closed in the 1950s. But really important part of just general American and world culture, as well as this history of our higher ed.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible place. From the first time I learned about it, I was fascinated. And one of the ways I finished this book was just feeling like I have to, tell the story, my own way of telling the story of this place. And and just to, so your listeners know, the book is Undeclared is built out of three very long essays and three shorter interludes. So they're not really chapters. They are thematic essays with multiple sections, almost as long as a short chapter. They each stand on their own and they complement each other. And so the longest of those three is a central essay on Black Mountain, and on aesthetic dimensions of formative education. So Black Mountain was founded in 1933, in North Carolina by a group of people who had sort of voluntarily left or were expelled from Rollins College for being troublemakers and questioning some of the sort of bureaucratic imperatives of that place. The founding figure was this guy, John Andrew Rice. He had to be sort of he talked into doing it. So he really wasn't like his idea exactly, but he was definitely the sort of central charismatic figure of the founding group. And it was tiny from beginning to end. And one of the reasons why I wanted to connect with your podcast and with the current microcollege movement is because early on in studying Black Mountain, I had to think about that. Why am I recommending to my readers? And we'll talk in a second about, well, what about a place that only lasted for 23 years? Does that mean it was flawed? And what about a place that is historical? How can that speak to the present? So there are those issues. But I also thought people are going to think, why are you talking about a place that, at most in its biggest years had something like 125, 150 students, but many years smaller? It's thought served a total of 1,200 students over its 23-year history. I realized, okay, well, I feel defensive about this, and I wonder if I could actually just address it head on and try to get people thinking about the question of scale in higher ed. And then I found that the Black Mountain founders themselves were right on top of that issue. They were well aware that they were doing something that differed. I mean, higher ed wasn't quite as massive as it is today, but there were obviously much bigger places. And they sort of threw down the challenge and they said, all right, feel free to call us small and therefore not a real college, but are you sure that you can truly educate people at these massive scales? Is that, are you sure that's not the prejudice? What makes, what is the right size for a community of learners? And then they added to that by saying things like, we want a community where people feel known, where people feel that they are enacting themselves in a community in which they have a place. And are you sure you can do that with 5,000 or 10,000 students? So they kind of threw down the gauntlet, and I really admire that aspect of them. But I guess the other thing to say to frame it for your listeners is this is a place that's often mistaken as an art school. And it's easy to see why that happens, because it turns out that a kind of incredible percentage of major figures in all of the arts pass through that place, either as students, as faculty, or also, and they had these summer institutes, so as summer faculty. So just it's just a roll call. If you go to MoMA in New York and walk through the galleries, you're going to be bumping into artists who were at Black Mountain. In the literary arts as well, there was a kind of moment where poetry in the United States was synonymous with Black Mountain. So it was a place that was steeped in the aesthetic. But another interesting thing that they were clear about from the very beginning is they weren't an art school. They didn't want to be an art school. So Josef Albers, the Bauhaus design thinker who emigrated fleeing Hitler and joined the faculty in its second year, Albers used to quip, we're not trying to make professional artists, but professionals in life, which is a silly way to put it. But I mean, we're trying to help people live a good life. And we think that includes developing your understanding, your self-knowledge, your grasp of the world. And we think a key medium for that is artistic, engagement, not just studying the arts as something somebody else made, appreciating this symphony or this painting, but actual classes in making, in performing, in composing. They put that at the center of the curriculum, but they put it there because they thought it was the key to general education, not because they were trying to produce artists, though many artists did come out of there.
Yeah,
That's just by way of an
let's drop
introduction.
some names there for a moment. Like they're the people
Okay.
who are associated with Black Mountain included people like Buckminster Fuller, John Cage. Can you just what are some of the other folks who were there?
Merce Cunningham. Black Mountain was the scene of what's considered the first happening, this crucial term in sort of in performance art. And that was sort of Cage and Cunningham working together with others. Charles Olson, a major figure in poetry. Who else was there? Some many great painters. I give a long list to sort of acknowledge that it's a who's who. But then you have to not be kind of confused by that to think, oh, what a great art colony or what a great art school. Because then you wouldn't be asking the question they wanted us to ask of ourselves, which is how do processes of engaging with a medium transform us?
Just one other name to mention that's been important for us is MC Richards, who has played a key role in the bringing of Waldorf education to the United States, and really a remarkable poet and potter, a ceramics artist, and who wrote beautifully about these integrative functions you're talking about between the plastic arts like ceramics, poetry and pedagogy, right? Writing. And so her writings have been influential in our work here, and definitely a key Black Mountain figure as well.
Yeah, not only was she great at writing about those integrative moments, but she modeled, she came into Black Mountain as a kind of, literary, in a literary critical mode. I'm going to teach courses on literature. But then she also got interested in theater and in translation from French. And as you say, started shifting into pottery. And, she was modeling this quest for whole personal development for her students, which I think is a really important thing for us to just remember, is that like one crucial aspect of education is modeling the thing you're talking about. And so if we only hire hyper specialists and they themselves are not interested in the quest for self-knowledge and developing the whole person, it's not clear that they could be stewards of an education for the whole person. But MC Richards was this kind of person who lived it. And many of the Black Mountain people, they attended each other's classes. They really stretched themselves. You mentioned Buckminster Fuller. I tell the story of how they talked him into being in a play, and he was just paralyzed with embarrassment and stage fright until the director worked with him to try to get past that. And what a gift for students to see this guy who's, just the leading figure in, holistic thinking around architecture and design, and speaking to large audiences around the world. But here he is, willing to be a novice in theater and to risk, to turn a corner in himself. That means there's going to be deeply awkward moments. So there was that ethos of pushing yourself to keep growing as a whole person, like MC Richards and Buckminster Fuller demonstrate.
So important. So I think the role of the arts, of aesthetic education as a part of this formative project of liberal education is so wonderful to see someone addressing this. As you mentioned, we both have daughters right now who are artists at Bard College, a great liberal arts college in the Hudson Valley. But I think even in this idea of whole person education as sort of mouthed at colleges and universities, liberal arts institutions with these scattering requirements. The fine arts are often even beyond that. They might not even have that requirement at all. So it seems like in this chapter, in this essay, using the example of Black Mountain, you're arguing there's a central role for the arts. And so in this project of formative education, of integration, what do the arts bring if they're not just training, professional artists who are going to go on and have a gallery shows and concerts and things like this, but are actually they might be doctors or farmers or whatever else they may be.
Yeah, so if we think about understanding the world as a kind of dialectical, and I'll explain what I mean by that, a kind of dialectical process by which an encounter with the world opens up a new sense of who you are, and so deepens your self-knowledge, which then enables you to open yourself more fully to the world, which then gives you, so you see, I'm trying to describe a kind of circle, widening circle of awareness of self and openness to the complexity of the world around you. I think the arts just really model, embody that dialogue in just the best way. There's something about working in a medium that simultaneously does not let you forget that, your vision matters. You are making something. And also it doesn't let you forget that you can't make it any which way you want, right? What is a medium? A medium is a set of enabling constraints. It pushes back. M.C. Richards talks poetically about the clay and how the clay, yields in some ways and resists in others. And having something that resists, if you're just writing some facile essay, moving words around, using ChatGPT, whatever it is, like, there's nothing pushing back and your thinking probably won't move forward. But the way in which actual, working with materials forces you to bump up against limits to yourself and find out that certain aspects of what you thought was the world were just your convenient fictions about the world, your hopes, your fears, your fantasies. The world pushes back, and the arts stage that in a way that is direct. And so Albers would have people head off in the woods to gather leaves for a collage. And the challenge was to working only with found objects, the fall leaves, to really think carefully about form and color and really see those leaves in relation. And generations of students who didn't necessarily go there to be artists testified to how transformative it was for them. To have to get out of their heads and really use their eyes. There's a thinker I like on this topic, Matthew Crawford. He wrote a book called Shop Class of Soulcraft. And then after that, he wrote a book that's really interesting called The World Beyond Your Head
A really
on,
great book. Both of those
right?
books are really awesome.
Yeah, and he's talking about sort of how much of modern life is encouraging a kind of insulation from reality. Right, in which we're put into a kind of virtual space with knobs to twist, but no actual practical engagement where the world pushes back. Already in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the faculty of Black Mountain recognized that if you want an honest transaction with the world, making was not something just for somebody called artists, or even worse, right, in our K-12 curriculum, if you work with your hands, that means you are not considered worthy of the college level track and you're being routed toward a vocational route. John Dewey was on the board of Black Mountain, along with Einstein and Jung, I think. I mean, it's quite the board, right? And Dewey admired Black Mountain. He said it was one of the clearest expressions of democracy in action he'd ever seen. They also, Rice admired Dewey, and this was Dewey's great theme was, can we create an education that heals that rift between head and hands?
Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah, I think in that one of the examples you use in the book, and here at Thoreau College, we also are engaged with the social arts, let's say theater, dance, singing together, Putting on, I would say, I would add to that, like staging an event, like a banquet or a meal or something that involves a lot of different parts. So I think working with other people is another example of that. I have a vision, like I want to hold that vision, want to articulate that, and bring that out into the world, and then that meets the not me, the world that is there to be formed, and that includes the visions and the abilities and the capabilities of other people too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I am curious to know what you thought about the theater parts of Black Mountain, because I know theater is central to what you do at Thoreau, and it was so important to Black Mountain from beginning to end. And they got the whole community involved, and they thought that there were special formative possibilities in theater, the way in which you have to bring yourself to the role, but there's also a little bit of distance. So you get to see an aspect of yourself you might not have seen if you're just, performing authenticity. I'm me, right? That there's a weird way in which being somebody else is a cool chance to be yourself more. There's some kind of paradox there, right? Where playing a part enables you to step into aspects of yourself that might have been hidden from you or subdued. Does that resonate with theater at Thoreau?
Absolutely. I think a couple interviews on the podcast with some of our theater or visiting theater instructors and directors, and they also talk about the educational opportunities presented by embodying quite different personalities, these characters. If you go up and you play a Shakespearean villain, let's say, or somebody of a very different kind of type than yourself, it allows you to actually live for a while in it and see the world from another perspective. And in the context of theater, also to do it multiple times through rehearsal and multiple performances, and there each performance is also a happening, right? An event
Yes.
that is has different qualities. The texture of time, the texture of space, like, is something that you are thinking about much more granularly in the case of theater. And then there's improv. I think a lot of what we do here is not performance. It's just play, right? Or it's, let's try this out. What if we did this? What if we turned it around? And there's something that's about, that then if you go to stage, let's say even something as mundane as a meeting or like I say, a dinner or some sort of an event like that, those are skills that are useful, and it allows you to actually be creative, work with space and time and things like lighting and the rhythm of events.
Yeah, don't you think that there's some misconceptions in this area, that there's like something called real life, and then there's imagination, which invents a fictional realm, right? There's regular life, and then there's theater. But as you're saying, like, there's lots of aspects of life that have a theatrical dimension. Can you tune into that dimension? What does the show must go on mean in other aspects of your life, and not just in theater? And what does it mean to sort of host an event? I love that idea that putting on a great banquet isn't just for students at Johnson and Wales or whatever, some college that's all about the hospitality
Hospitality, yeah.
industry, right? But hospitality is a deep aspect of human life, right?
Yeah, ancient, yeah. So we're running up towards the end of the hour here. And before I let you go, I wanted to ask about the third essay in the book, which also addresses another really deep and important concept. We've alluded to it a couple times, but this is the idea of vocation. And yeah, I think that you've already kind of suggested some of the ways that's a term that's used thoughtlessly, or there's different, like, deeper ways to think about it. I can share, I definitely see that as a core part of our work here at Thoreau College, of my work as an educator. And these sort of playful spaces or semi-formal spaces of conversation are often important for those coming about. And it is, moments of realizing vocation, people are becoming aware of their important work, are just so powerful and precious to experience, and really are the golden moments for me as a teacher. But yeah, can you share a little bit about what you thought about this idea of vocation, and how a higher education institution or a teacher might actually encourage, facilitate that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, working in universities, my whole career, I found myself as somebody rooted in the humanities and philosophy, educational philosophy, but in philosophy, I found that again and again, the humanities were asked to sort of defend their existence and their worth in terms of vocational payoff, which was in turn defined as number of people who land the job they want in X number of years, average salary after graduation. And so then the humanist has these two choices. Neither of them, to me, seems like a good choice. One is play that metrics game. And in fact, actually, it turns out that humanities graduates over a longer term do just fine or better. And then it turns out that institutional selectivity in our weird system matters more than major. And so you could try to play that game and you could say, hey, actually, no, not all graduates are baristas. Many of them are gainfully employed. Look, that option, I think, ultimately we lose. We end up reinforcing this bottom line mentality of education in which the humanities, they get redescribed as something that they're not. And so even if they continue in name, their spirit dies off. However, I've really tired of the usual alternative, which is to say, hey, we do something other than vocational education. College isn't just about finding a job. College is also about becoming a citizen or something like that. It's not that it's wrong, it's 100% right. Vocation is not the only aim of the university. But what I realized was there was a third option that was getting dropped, which was embracing the idea that vocation is a central mission for the university, but then refusing the reduction of that to learning the technical skills to be trained for a job and, networking, credentialing so you can get the job. Those are two aspects of vocational enactment, but why do we always stop there? So to say that we do something more than that, or to say we do that too, misses the point of saying, what if we took vocation, vocational enactment, vocational formation, what if we took that really seriously and thought about what it entails? My hunch was then we'd realize the university is not doing a good job, even though everyone says it's become too vocationalized, that maybe it's been jobified, but it's not really vocationalized at all. The other thing we might find is that the humanities obviously have a central role once we have a more expansive definition of vocation. And I won't go through the whole argument, but maybe I'll mention the first of the questions I think we tend to beg, just because it's mind-blowing that we beg it and really problematic. And that's what I call the great vocational question of what is a worthy form of work to which I am suited? Now, some people might say, well, that's crazy to think that we skip over that, because how can you train for a line of work if you haven't chosen a vocation? And how can you credential and network if you haven't? And then I want to say, okay, yeah, but asking students to matriculate directly into a school, as most universities do, at the ripe age of 17, with the deep self-knowledge of a 17-year-old or who 17-year-old who maybe never encountered a very wide range of human practices, to ask them to choose at that point their vocation, that's bad faith. That's not really engaging in vocational discernment.
Also,
You want
some
to talk?
really complex financial constraints that are going into that too, is what I see students like. I really like this, or like I feel I'm good at this, but that's never, they think what they think about also as a 17-year-old in financial sense is that distorts the what they end up focusing on.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's a lot of parental pressure. So when universities say, well, that'd be too paternalistic to not just trust that students can pick their own major and their own career, that'd be paternalistic. It's like, okay, so why aren't you worried about the fact that they made that decision, both because your admission form asked them to pick a college or school to, in which to matriculate, and also because their parents were breathing down their neck and say, be a dentist or whatever it is. So I say, all right, let's think about vocational discernment seriously. You'd have to have some degree of self-knowledge to know what kind of work suits you. You have to have a sense of what brings you joy and what you're good at and your values and what matters to you, right? And to know whether a form of work is worthy, you'd have to deepen those values and really develop your ethical compass and say, what do I stand for? And also, you'd have to learn a wider range of sort of the practices human beings have devised for themselves. So I think what you need then is the classic thing that the humanities always aimed for, which was true liberal learning. And we could define that as education which creates a space not just for the question, how do I get what I already learned to want, but opens up a space for that weirder, more uncanny question, what's worth wanting in the first place? What's worth wanting to have, but also to be or to do, to accomplish? The humanities are answers to that question. They are descriptions of what we've our projects, what we've prized, and why. Exposure to that is a prerequisite, I would say, for making an informed decision about the kind of work you want to put at the center of your life. So I do that with four different questions, but the first is this question of what kind of work suits you and is valuable. And we can't, I don't think we could skip over that. So I say, yeah, let's double down on vocation, but let's start taking it more seriously and think about how somebody enacts vocation over time throughout a life, because vocational choice isn't one and done at the age of 18 or one and done at the age of 22. Even if you've chosen a line of work, you still have the task of finding your vocation within that work. And you may, just to give a little glimpse of the final section of this chapter, you may also have the task of realizing that you have to leave your work to find your vocation. Something about the way the practice is institutionalized in our world, or what you've discovered about it and yourself and your fit, it could be that one of the greatest pieces of vocational wisdom you need to learn is how to leave your vocation if and when the time comes.
Yeah, that, I mean, we live in a time of great transformation and change as well. That's something that may be an essential life skill for more and more people, is to discover, a new vocation or to adapt it to new conditions.
Yeah, you're making me realize I have to distinguish my account maybe from a kind of flexibility that our late stage capitalism demands of everybody, right?
Well, that's one of the like the arguments I think that you kind of talk about early on, that the kind of shallow arguments for the liberal arts, right? Is that it allows you to do that. You'll have to change your job 10 times in your life or whatever, and
Learning how to learn, right?
right.
More cliches, right? And yet, I think there are all kinds of situations where it's time to move on. But it's hard because if you really invested in your practice, it's helped to shape you. So it's actually helped to shape your judgment about what's worth doing.
Yeah.
So how do you develop and follow up on that little glimmer you have that you're suffering from a kind of vocational Stockholm syndrome? You've learned to love your prison. How do you act on that insight and move on and keep growing? Dewey said, he was a great theorist of vocation, and he said our fundamental vocation is our ongoing intellectual and moral growth.
Beautiful.
So you
Yeah, I
ask.
think that's a great summary of the themes of your book, actually, because I think in there is an art of living, right, that's being pointed to here that involves something that's coming from within, that's self-discernment, self-knowledge, and then there is the world, right? And so we, hopefully through education and the way that you're describing it, and it's being discovered and practiced, is allowing, that harmonious kind of synergy to come together, and the way that the world is enriched by the work that you're doing, and you are in harmony with it. So
Can I just mention for your listeners, if they're interested in the book, it is available open access through MIT Press.
oh, cool.
So the complete electronic version is downloadable. However, I would say that the physical copy is also really nice. The cover is designed by my daughter.
Oh, nice. Good enough. Yeah, thank you. We can if you send me that link, I can put that into the notes for the show. And thank you for doing that. That's amazing. And thank you for talking with us, Chris. This is really a wonderful conversation and wonderful book. Great to have this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on, for your interest in my work, and just it's important for people looking for an alternative to the contemporary multiversity to be talking to each other about what we're doing, what we're seeing, and openings, possibilities.
Amen. Thank you.